this week on The Inswinger.
But this is big for Arsenal, I think, because you look at the away games they've had to play early in this season. Taken out of context of this game, it's a good point. And I think they have to respect that point, respect the way that they played.
The more surprising thing about City was the fact that they weren't really doing much in that second half.
The question was Lopetegui the right guy to bring in? A lot of us were hesitant, and this is why.
Never scored a goal until his testimonial match. And there were absolute scenes.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to the Inswinger Season 4, Episode 3. I'm Charlie DiMatteo, joined alongside
Harrison McGlashan.
It was a clash at the top of the table between Arsenal and Man City the last 2 years, winners of the Premier League and runners-up. They met last spring. Arsenal were able to come away with a point, 0-0 draw. Many people criticized their approach in that game, playing it a bit too conservative. Perhaps it cost them the league. It did not go that way on Saturday. It was all action. It was from the get-go, from literally less than 10 seconds in. It was Havertz barging into Haaland, setting the tone, a physical tone. Rodri went off injured. I mean, so much happened in this game that we need to get to, but what is your instant reaction, so to speak, Harrison, from this thriller 2-2 at the Etihad?
Well, you're right. Just a lot to process. I think for Arsenal, you probably take a point at halftime, but at the end of the game, it felt like 2 points dropped. It was just a total bizarre sort of sequence of events that happened. I thought the first half was pretty even. I thought Man City had more possession at home, as expected. The XG had it pretty even, slightly in Man City's favor. So it was a good game. It was a tight game, even game. Haaland gets through, puts them ahead, which set up the game for Arsenal to go and attack, which I liked as a neutral. Calafiori scores a great goal to equalize, and then Gabriel's there with his trademark header towards the end of the half from a corner, and you're thinking, what a second half we're going to have here. And then Trossard gets the second yellow for kicking the ball away, and the game totally changes. And, on that, I mean, it by the letter of the law, it's a yellow card because you can't kick the ball away. Does he hear the whistle? I don't know. If he does, he knows exactly what he's doing, and it's stupid to do that, really.
Especially given what happened with Rice 2 weeks ago.
Exactly. So I think he should know better. Again, it wasn't the shove. It was kicking the ball away, which the referee, to be fair to him, who was having a difficult game, I thought, in tough circumstances, I think it's probably the right call. You can't kick the ball away. That's the rule. Whether you agree with the rule or not is a different sort of conversation, but yeah, unfortunate for Arsenal because they were playing well. They had the lead. Now the second half comes, they've got to sit in and defend, which they were very capable of doing. I thought it was an exceptional second half defensive performance. And honestly, they deserve the win just for that because it was just outstanding. Arteta set them up in a 5-4 with no center forward, and they so nearly got over the line and limited Man City to really just some shots from outside the box. I didn't think Man City really had an answer. Pep brings on John Stones, and you're like, all right, he's going to throw a bit more size in there. And then, of course, in the 96th, 97th minute, he pokes one in, a scrappy goal from a corner. So, listen, I think if you're Arsenal, you probably take a point at halftime. You're down to 10, you're thinking City are going to get at least one here. Can we limit them to just that? But with, literally seconds to the finish line and you let that slip, it's so unfortunate. You're disappointed, and you just think, I'm sure the fans were just ready to go absolutely ballistic, and they get over that hurdle that they haven't been able to. And I thought they deserved to, just on both halves' performance. They were right there, away from home, and they haven't beaten them yet, like I said. So that would have been just huge for them to do. But it isn't a bad point. This is Man City at the end of the day. I think we have to remember that. They were down to 10 men. You do take a point. But just an outstanding game. It had a little bit of everything. And I think Arsenal definitely have a lot to be proud of for that performance.
Yeah, it was a cracker. Old school cracker. Great game for the neutral. The definition of that from the get-go. And I think the big thing for Arsenal is that they went toe-to-toe in that first half when it was 11-11. They played their stuff. They took chances when they had them. Quality bits and pieces of play. They easily, heads could have dropped when they went down early through that Haaland goal. I thought Savinha was brilliant again. I think he's a Mahrez regen in every sense of the way. He's brilliant. But this is big for Arsenal, I think, because you look at the away games they've had to play early in this season. taken out of context of this game, it's a good point. And I think they have to respect that point, respect the way that they played, and take it in confidence, saying, hey, you know, we came here last time, played for the 0-0 and got it when we needed the point. But we came here to win, and we came damn close, probably should have won. I know it'll feel like a backbreaker with that last-minute goal, but that's Man City for you. The inevitability that we've talked about so many friggin' times on this show came back to bite them once again. But does this result say more about Arsenal or City? And what I mean by that is, you know, Arsenal, we've asked the question, can they go again against City after the way they've let it slip, so to speak, but fallen short 2 years in a row? Or is this City again saying, hey, we didn't have De Bruyne, Rodri's gone for the rest of the season probably,
and we
still nicked a point. We still came when we didn't look like we deserved anything from the game. We got a point. What does it say? What's the more, you know?
Well, I don't know. I think because we did all expect them to get that point as soon as Arsenal go down to 10 men. So I don't think that came as a surprise. The more surprising thing about City was the fact that they weren't really doing much in that second half. They were just sort of taking a few pops from outside the box. I thought Foden came on probably too late in the game. I think he's a player you want in and around the 18-yard box to pop one in. I didn't see much overlap or underlap. You know, it was just a bit dull from them, uncharacteristically. So I found that interesting. And for Arsenal, I mean, I think you could say, listen, we expect this team to be defensively elite, and to, you know, they are more than capable of soaking up pressure. So I think when you think about it, really, and take a step back, you think, I think I could see Arsenal doing that. You know, we saw them do it last year. They got the point at the Etihad. So nothing too surprising when you think about that. I would actually say the more surprising thing was maybe what you alluded to, the fact that they went at them more in that first half. They were toe-to-toe. They attacked much more than they did last year. So they're getting better at the Etihad each season. They haven't gotten the 3 points yet, but an improved performance there. But yeah, I was honestly surprised with the lack of answers that City had in the second half. That was the takeaway for me there. Yeah.
For our hockey audience, which we may have one, you know, we're in Boston.
Yeah.
It looked like a really bad power play for that entire second half. You know, they had the man advantage, but it was Ruben Diaz, like, running things, which was like, well, why is Ruben Diaz, you know, setting each attack outside the box? Shouldn't, you know, Foden be there or Savinho or somewhere else? A bit more Grealish didn't do much. God knows him, if the low block does not add up well. And it was a lot of just rinse and repeat of Arsenal, once they cleared the ball, got back in their shape. And they deserve credit for that because a lot of teams, you know, Man City would put a crooked number up against, but not Arsenal. So they come away with a point. All right, moving on to, it was a Saturday morning, 12:30 kickoff at the London Stadium. My boys, West Ham, were drubbed against Enzo Maresca's Chelsea. Enzo Maresca, fun fact, was part of Pellegrini's backroom staff when he was West Ham manager, which I had zero recollection about. I saw all these pictures of him, and he was one of Pellegrini's guys, which I really just didn't remember at all.
Wow.
So he was coming back to the London Stadium. And Chelsea's quality shone through. I'll give my take. I'll let you go first. What did you make of Chelsea's 3-0 win? I mean, was this more Chelsea good or West Ham bad? Bit of both.
Yeah, definitely a bit of both. But I have to say, I mean, we might, I mean, it's early days. We might be eating our words a little bit with Chelsea. I mean, my boy Jackson, he's done it again. The guy looks great. I think you just had a great game. Chelsea looked lightning quick, man. When they got the ball to their danger men out wide, They're tough to stop, and I think they were just so dangerous on the break. They looked like they could have scored every time West Ham turned the ball over, really, which I think is that won't happen in every game. I think West Ham were exceptionally poor in transition there. But listen, they're playing to their strengths. Jackson running in behind, getting the ball out wide, midfield runners in and around the box. João Felix had a couple chances. Like, I'm seeing something that I don't mind, and yet you have to place a lot of credit on Maresca there for the way this team's playing. I think Levi Colwill has taken a big step forward this season. So I don't mind the way they're set up. I think they have plenty of work to do to sort of trim the fat a little bit on this massive squad, find the best 11 with one or two rotating. How do you get Nkunku in this team? Because, boy, he's a talent. Where does Pedro Neto play?
And João Felix.
Nani Madueke seems to have to play now because he's outstanding. João Felix. So are some of these guys going to be happy on the bench? Because some of them inevitably will be on the bench.
Yeah.
So listen, he's going to have to deal with that more longer term. But right now they're playing good football. They look really dangerous. And yeah, the attacking talent is just fun to watch. They're a fun team to watch. And, you know, I think West Ham just, they couldn't run with them, really. I mean, the first goal was just really casual defending. People jogging back, Mavropanos in no man's land. Just a poor goal to concede. I thought Chelsea were just having a field day in behind the West Ham defense. Jackson went through on goal twice in the first, like, 20 minutes. Alvarez got exposed. He was chasing him for both goals, which that just shouldn't be happening, that your defensive mid is dragged out in a foot chase with Chelsea center forward. And I thought the commentator said it best, actually. He said, when they lose the ball, they're so easy to play through. Yeah. And that's a problem. And that you have to look at Lopetegui there and say, you got to make us a little bit tougher to beat here. So I thought the good news is, you know, West Ham did look a threat with Kudus especially. Like, there are players there who we know can score goals and create things. So there were a couple moments where you thought they looked threatening, but defensively definitely looks to be an issue.
Yeah. I think there's massive signs of concern. I think with West Ham, we're kind of stuck in this loop where people are now saying, oh, you got rid of David Moyes, you know, be careful what you wish for, which I can't stand, because if you look at how bad we were defensively in the second part of last season, I mean, we were shipped 5 to Fulham away, 5 to Liverpool, 6 to Arsenal at home. We were shipping goals left, right, and center. So it wasn't that Moyes was the right guy to take us forward. The question was Lopetegui the right guy to bring in? And I think a lot of us were hesitant, and this is why, because we were all like, you know, what kind of football is he going to play? Is he going to try this expansive stuff? If so, I mean, he's a bit past his prime. Is he going to get buy-in from the players? And what you're seeing, like you said, is a team that's really easy to play against, that does not have a set identity defensively, has this some kind of wishy-washy, oh, we want to play with the ball, we've got possession-based players, but don't really know what to do with it in the final third. And what you get is the result you got on Saturday at the weekend, you know, massively discouraging performance. I think questions need to be asked about, you know, the midfield. Like you said, Alvarez constantly out of position. I've seen Alvarez have brilliant games. I saw him at Old Trafford when we lost 3-0 to United. You were there too. You know, we were crap, but he was great. Like, you know, he played some brilliant passes, was good in the challenge, had a good understanding of the game. But then he turns in performances like that where he looked like a complete liability in midfield tactically. Guido Rodriguez didn't even look fit, got hooked off for 37 minutes for Suchek. And when you're playing for a possession-based manager, that's a damning decision if you're Guido Rodriguez, because Thomas Suchek is not a ball-playing midfielder by any sense of the word. No. So you get rid of guys like Ward-Prowse, you bring in Soler, who came off the bench, didn't really do much again. And, you know, what is the identity of this team? I don't know what it is. Yeah. That's the underlying issue. Context, I don't think we're any like in trouble of going down this year because of players that are there. But when you speak of transition, and I think I was wary of this, I think West Ham fans were wary of, you know, it's going to take some time to develop this team. But what we're seeing is Lopetegui kind of just throw idea after idea and nothing's sticking. It's not like I have these players and I'm going to play this way. It's like, all right, well, we brought these players in. Let's figure out how to get them, you know, in the best way, which shows, I think, a flaw in the recruitment. If you're not recruiting for a specific style, I think you're recruiting wrong, to be honest with you. I think the players you bring in have to suit a specific style. And if that style is not nailed down, how do you know how these players are going to fit in? Your trial and error in games. That's what you get. You get 3-0 against Chelsea at home. It's trial and error, not a recipe for success. So I think the question, again, is what is Lopetegui's style? Who fits it? Who can play it the best? Because he was backed with players that cost money, that have proven quality, proven goals, proven pedigree. And right now, he's not even close to delivering. If we had seen a semblance of play that is starting to take shape and, you know, we were conceding the odd goal because someone was at a position, like, that's different. It's structural, a lack of structural intelligence amongst the team. And that stems from Lopetegui. Yes, you can point fingers at, you know, Mavropanos and Alvarez for poor games against Chelsea. But ultimately, Mavropanos is not quick enough to play a high line. Yeah. Alvarez, why is he so high up? The pressing, he loves to do that. He loves to just go and press someone, you know, on the other side of the pitch, but that doesn't work. Lopetegui needs to be the guy to say, hey, no, that's not your role. Play this way. Let someone else do the running. So that's my issue. It's a lack of tactical understanding amongst the team. So there's a bit of worry, definitely, but I can't stand this whole Moyes thing because Moyes had to go. I think a lot of West Ham fans wanted Amorim brought in. There was the whole David Sullivan thing. They flew him in. He interviewed. Then he apologized for doing the interview. And Lopetegui was far from the inspiring choice. But here he is. Here he is.
Yeah, no, they've got work to do, I think, because you hit the nail on the head with identity. I don't know if Lopetegui wants to play possession football. I don't know if this squad suits possession football. I think when you look at Kudus and Bowen and these guys, they're quick, they run in behind, they carry the ball. On paper, it looks like a transition team.
It suits David Moyes' style.
And think they have not, not done well at home when they've tried to keep the ball. I just see West Ham on paper, and this could change, as like away from home, we're going to hit you on the break. We've got so much pace in attack. We've got people who can finish from wide areas. Like, I don't know. I think there are players who can nick it around. Paqueta, obviously, you know. But yeah, nothing quite seems to be sticking, and there's just it just screams identity crisis.
The leap you have to make as a mid-table team, which is what West Ham were last year, to become a possession-based team, you have to be so committed to that philosophy. Even when you look at teams like Brighton in the past, who have been mid-table, but they've been possession-based and like mid-table, their whole recruitment philosophy, manager, everything is on the same page of how we're going to play week in, week out, regardless of opposition, if you're home or away. And right now with West Ham, it just doesn't seem like they're committed to either one. And you got to say, it's more this, like, we're stuck in a time loop here from when we sacked David Moyes the first time, didn't give him a new contract, brought Pellegrini in, wanted to play this position-based football, bought loads of players, had an okay first season, and then it fizzled out. And then you bring David Moyes back in because, you know what, you know, he's probably more proven and he's harder to play against and countering suits a mid-table team more. Oh, but we're sick of him, so let's bring in another. Like, it's deja vu, which is a bit maddening, but time will tell. Before we get into one more game, we had some big news with your boys, Everton. Finally, it seems like, knock on wood, because we've been here before with 777 and whoever else, seems like Everton are headed towards new ownership. What can you tell us about the Americans that are behind this bid and what this could mean for the future of your football club?
Well, this is huge. I mean, the deal has been agreed. The only thing we're waiting on, which will take probably 8 to 12 weeks, is the approval process from the Premier League. But I see no reason why the Friedkin Group cannot pass that test. They already own one football club and seem to have cash, and they just seem like competent people. So, listen, this is big for Everton. Mashiri's running out of money. We know that. He doesn't want any part of this anymore. The fans don't want him anymore. We've talked about that on previous episodes. So that's good. It's an all-cash bid, which is great. No debt. We don't want to have to owe anyone any more money. That was a big problem.
777 loans.
Oh, my God. 777, yeah. I mean, that was a train wreck. I don't even know why he wanted to get involved with those people in the first place, because they had no money, and they were borrowing money, and we would have – it was just – anyway, total nightmare. But they in the brief statement we got, they used the word stability, and I think that's just exactly what we need. That's probably what the fans want to hear right now. Come in this season, if Deitch can get us to the end of the season, we assess things, we go into the new stadium as a Premier League club, hopefully improve upon last season, hopefully have a bit more money to spend, bring in some new players, and hopefully have owners who will want to invest. And I think they've done that at Roma. It's been up and down. They had Mourinho, they had De Rossi, a little, some different things, but they've got a Conference League to their name, which Everton fans will look and say, hey, they won a trophy. I think the Friedkins know what they're doing in terms of taking a bit of a backseat. You don't see them much. You don't hear from them much in the media. They trust a few people to run the club. And that, you know, we've been down the road where an owner is getting involved and has one idea. A director of football has another idea. Bill Kenwright has another idea. And it just doesn't work. So Everton fans want to see a vision. We've talked a lot about identity in this sort of 2024 football world. I think you kind of need that. So, listen, hopefully they'll lay out a plan. I think they'll probably be very much in the background again and pick few people that they trust to run this business, because it is a business. So hopefully those people are the right men for the job. We don't know, you know, how it's going to look yet. But it's a good feeling to have some people who want to invest in your football club. And the rumors are they're going to inject a ton of cash in, which is great and much needed. But we've got a new stadium. We will be earning more revenue through that already. So let's get a plan in place And hopefully we can just, you know, I don't want to just say we can just survive, because I think Everton have a better team than just survival. I think we proved that last season when we take away the points deduction, we were well clear, right? So I think the Premier League is really competitive. I think we'll be in the bottom half comfortably. I think hopefully we can hover above the relegation zone for most of the season and be in not too much danger. But we're not looking great right now. A little bit of improvement. But yeah, stability. That's the key. That's the word they use. So I'm happy with that. And yeah, I mean, I'll continue to do my research on these guys and sort of what they've done at Roma. But I think Roma and Everton are kind of similar sort of size clubs in a way. They've got a big rival that share a city, big fan base, big stadium. So yeah, I mean, listen, it's just good to get rid of Mascheri, to be honest. It's good to have a bit of clarity on the situation. And it's good to have people who seem to want to, you know, invest in this, in their words, an iconic football club, which Everton is. It is, as the cliche goes, a sleeping giant, right? So let's get back up there. And I think honestly, any takeover, regardless of, and we've seen this with Newcastle, I know they made the Champions League 1 year, but this is a slow burn.
Yeah.
With these PSR rules, and yes, it might change, you're not going to be able to spend the money you have. I don't care if you're Saudi, Abu Dhabi, or Texas-based Friedkin. It's like, it doesn't really matter. You have to be savvy in the market. You have to have a plan in place. You have to be a Brighton. You have to invest smartly, and you have to earn money so you can spend money. So we need people who know how to run a business, because it is a business. It's not just about, you know, Sir Alex Ferguson plucking the best players from the lower half of the Premier League and, you know, staying up there. So this is not the Barclays era, which we'll talk about later in the episode, a bit of a teaser. I'm excited. I'm sure the fans are too. It's nice to have a bit of clarity on this situation, which has just been an absolute roller coaster ride over the past couple years. So hopefully it goes through. Premier League, just please approve new owners for us. My God.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head towards the end there, and that it's not really about the money you can even spend. It's how you spend it. And the Brighton model, you know, people talk about that, but to me, it's really just good scouting. It's being able to find players for cheap. It's being able to negotiate and sell players for what they're worth. And you've seen so many times with, like, United especially, how bad they've been at selling, how poor they've been at buying, and the mess they're in, and Ineos and Ratcliffe are trying to amend that. I think you have to hope for similar themes with these guys in Everton. And you don't want to see I'm remembering that, you know, Davy Klaassen, Sigurdsson transfer
window.
The
famous 2018 summer.
Yeah, where you bought everyone and they all stunk. And so that has to be the goal. Strategy behind
it. I mean, it's
everything.
I come back to Brighton. The manager is not the most important person at that club anymore. And that is a damning indictment. Like, De Zerbi goes, you're thinking, oh, geez, he was great. But we got this new guy, does a little bit different, but the idea is the same.
Yeah.
The players are the same, and it's a seamless transition. It's all about direction, ideas. So it doesn't matter when you lose your best players and managers.
Yeah.
You've got the next guy ready to go.
And it's like a separation of powers almost. So that if one thing fails, the whole club doesn't fail.
Right.
You know, if the manager goes, like you said, the players are still there. If, you know, Chelsea took half their friggin', you know, backroom staff and scouting department, and they're running Chelsea now. But Brighton are still ticking along. So that's, I think Tony Bloom is his name.
The owner. Tony Bloom.
It starts with him. So if the Friedkins can come to Everton and do a similar thing, I think that's what you know Everton fans are going to be wanting.
That's what all fans, I think, should be wanting, right? Yeah. I mean, that's just the world now. That is the football world. That's how you do it.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into the return of the random, not so random segment of the week. It's a big one. It's a trend that's been taking Twitter by storm. It's the Barclays men trend. So we've each got an 11. I've gone for a 4-4-2 because I feel like there's no other choice with
me
the Barclays. We're going to give our shouts. And if you're not familiar with the trend, these are guys who, you know, been around the block, didn't play for always the biggest teams per se. They can, but not always. And really left their mark on the Premier League, just represent that, you know, mid-2000s to 2015 nostalgia, great kits, great goals.
Yeah, celebrations maybe. Something to influence culture and fans. And you hear the term cult hero, right? Streets won't forget. It's those sorts of players who played in the Premier League between 2001 and 2016, when the Barclays Bank was the main sponsor, hence the name Barclays Men. So we're looking for, it can be, it's a wide array of players, and some more talented than others, I'm sure. But yeah, we're looking for people who, you know, have influenced the Premier League fan, whether it be, you know, in a fan culture way, or just something that stood out and shone, not for the biggest clubs necessarily. That's sort of the trend here. So shout out to Cultures Football Podcast for coming up with the idea. A lot of people have hopped on. This is a fun discussion of sort of an alternative view of the Premier League names from yesteryear.
Let's get into it. Let's start in goal. Mm. All right, I'll go first. Yep. This guy, I think he was actually my goalkeeper and like my all-time personal 11.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. 390 Premier League appearances.
Okay.
Played for Stoke, played for United, Watford, West Brom. Even made a trip to Wrexham, not in the Premier League, far down. It's big boy Ben Foster.
Okay.
Ben Foster not only did it for a multitude of Premier League teams, did it at a pretty high level. You don't play 390 Premier League games without having some quality. I think he's, you know, a prototypical Barclays-era goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Who, especially towards the end of his career, he's got a big YouTube following now, the Cycling GK. He's got a podcast with Goldbridge. He gets former players on. I think he's a very well-liked guy. And to me, he's the ideal Barclays man keeper.
Mm, yeah, interesting. I didn't think of him, to be honest, but that's a good shout. Journeyman. Yeah, I like it. I've gone for, and I have to say, a lot of American goalkeepers that are eligible for this position. I went for one of them. Not the guy you'd think. I've gone for Brad Friedel.
Okay.
A little bit more of a throwback. Of course, an American. 450 Premier League appearance. He scored a goal, which is an automatic just sort of Barclays men streets
and
won't forget moment.
And so did Tim Howard.
So did Tim Howard, who amazing. I was thinking of. And we'll have some Everton players in here. But I don't want to go for Tim. I feel like Tim's too good.
Yeah.
I think you can be too good to be a Barclays man. Like Wayne Rooney, not a Barclays man. He's too good. Right. But yeah, scored a goal for Blackburn and they still lost. Like, that's just, I just love that. Played for Liverpool, actually, Blackburn, Aston Villa. That's really where I remember. I feel like Brad Friedel and then Brad Guzan was in there too. He was on my thinking and Spurs as well. So, you know, I'd like to, you know, shout out an American in there. There's nothing like an iconic bald American goalie. We've had a few of them. So would like to, you know, shout out Brad Friedel. He was a tidy goalkeeper in his day.
All right. Moving on to right back, you know, this one, you could say he's too good to be a Barclays man.
Mm.
I just love him. He was Man City's right back forever. Came to West Ham, did a job even in his old years. I'm going with Pablo Zabaleta. 309 Premier League appearances. He was a Man City player, but he didn't have – it wasn't – he was at Man City relatively early, and he had this kind of grittiness about him. This is why I think he's a Barclays man. He wasn't this modern right back who was a wing back who – you know, came into midfield like they do for Spurs and City now. He was a proper right back, a proper fullback. I think he's a suitable choice at right back. You can say he's too good, played for a big club. He's the only one I've got who was really only played for a traditional top six team. But I went for Zabaleta. He's got a soft spot.
Yeah, he's definitely borderline, but I think his traits as a player are definitely worth discussing. That you're right. He's not that sort of fly forward, talented, attacking fullback. He's got a little bit more grit. Argentinians are good here.
Yeah,
they, you know, they have a bit about them. So I've gone for an Everton cult hero. Spent his entire career at his boyhood club, Tony Hibbert.
Okay,
proper Barclays man.
David Moyes legend.
Famously never scored a goal until his testimonial match. And there were absolute scenes. And the fans invaded the pitch when Tony Hibbert scored. So he's just a classic. He wasn't very good. But boy, he was he's a fan favorite because of his love for the club. And that testimonial goal was hilarious. It was a free kick, he just hit it low. And then there was you would not have thought it was a testimonial match given the fan reaction at Goodison that night. So Tony Hibbert, what a guy.
Good choice. All right, moving on to center back. We'll go two at a time. How about that?
Yeah.
First center back, right-footed, Ryan Shawcross.
Oh,
yeah.
One
club man, 317 appearances. Later made the move to Inter Miami. Can't think of two places more different than Stoke and Miami.
Yeah.
But this guy epitomizes bit of Brexit, you know, bald head, skinhead, big strapping center back. You can rely on him in the Premier League. Not fancy whatsoever. He's just going to get stuck in, be a good, solid defender. I think he epitomizes that era of defending in the Premier League. You know, you didn't really have ball-playing center backs who would stride out with the ball. You had no-nonsense defenders, and that's exactly what Ryan Shawcross was. Next, on the left side, West Ham, bit of a cult hero, I think you could call him, New Zealander, Winston Reid. Came over early, I think late 2000s, scored West Ham's last and winning goal at Upton Park in a 3-2 win versus Man United.
That's big.
Will forever be embedded in Bowling Ground, Upton Park folklore. You know, I still remember that Peter Drury call. He rose so high, nearly touched the sky.
Yeah.
Winston Reid scores the goal.
Yes,
and he was just
a bit
of a quality defender on his day. He had a goal in him. Bit of pace about him, left-footed. I think he's ideal for this squad.
Yes, I like that pick. I remember him. My center back's sort of a journeyman. It did stop at Everton for a few years. Sylvain Distan, big, bald French center back. Played for Man City, Portsmouth, Everton, and Bournemouth at the end of his career. 469 appearances from... He was in the Premier League from 2002 to 2016, so really... almost the full Barclays era. But yeah, I remember him relatively well at Everton alongside Jagielka. But Portsmouth also have a few good shouts in here, a little bit before our time. But yeah, Sylvain Distan, just a nice addition here. But I got to get some non-English players in here as well.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Yeah, Distan was good for Everton, man. He was no nonsense. He was tidy, though. I like Distan, and, you know. Went around the league, sort of Man City pre Sheikh Mansour is always. They had a few Barclays men in their day as well. So, yeah, Distan. And then this is an interesting one. I haven't seen him thrown around at all. And maybe this is just me. I haven't seen him thrown around in the Barclays men chat on social media. But Fabrizio Colaccini, I don't know if you remember this guy, Argentinian center back, played for Newcastle. And what stood out to me was his hair. He had the famous long curly hair. 2008 to 2016, great song the fans had for him. I'm not gonna sing it on the pod because we might get removed from Apple Podcasts or whatever. I'm not sure if it's appropriate, but go look it up if you can find it. I remember he had a great song, and I'm a sucker for the look. I think that could be big here. You think of, like, people always talk about Jimmy Bullard in this category. He had the big, he had the mullet back in the day, playing for Wigan and Hull City, and, you know, so Colaccini. The fans loved him. He was in Newcastle for a while. Great hair. Another Argentine. He's in.
All right, moving on to left back. I think we'll have the same guy here. I think. I've gone for an Everton legend.
Yeah, I thought you would.
Yeah, 420 appearances. The epitome of a Barclays man. He was there for pretty much the entire era. Leighton Baines, you know, steady. Could score a banger of a free kick for a large part of his career, was one of the best left backs in the league. You just knew what you were going to get. He had kind of that crappy old Beatles-like haircut. You know, talking about haircut. He had that kind of shabby look to him, but he wasn't a shabby player. He was a quality player.
No, he was great.
I think he's the perfect left back.
He's too good to be a Barclays man.
Really?
He's not in my team. If Ashley Cole isn't alive, Baines is England's left back. Therefore, he's too good.
But Ashley Cole is alive.
I know, but Baines would have been the guy. I don't know. I thought it was too obvious. I love Leighton Baines. He's a legend. A lot of people have him here. Left back is also tough. I couldn't find many. But I didn't go for Baines. I just thought he was too good. I didn't want to limit him to just Barclays men category. He was an outstanding player. I think he was the second best left back to Ashley Cole in the league for a while. And I think he would have played so much more for England if it wasn't for Ashley Cole's fitness and reliability and just outstanding qualities. So I actually went for a Liverpool player, John Arnarisa, a Norwegian left back, 321 Premier League appearances, 21 goals. I think the being of Scandinavian descent helps you here. It's a hard-nosed sort of vibe often about these guys. So, yeah, I don't know. I was tempted by Baines. I wanted to go for something a little more obscure. He is an Everton legend. I feel like if you're... I think there's a difference between club legend and cult hero. And Baines is right on the border because he didn't win anything at Everton. But he was a fan favorite and we loved him. And he's a legend for me because I've never seen Everton lift a trophy. But, you know, a little bit gray area there with the Barclays men. Can you be, you know, club legend, you know, Premier League Hall of Fame maybe even, and in this category? We don't know.
True.
But yeah Arnarisa is a... I don't know. He's an interesting sort of character, but more of a hard-nosed sort of looking guy that I wanted to Okay. In here, toughen up the back line.
All right, let's get into midfield. Yeah. I've got two central midfielders. Can't say there's a lot of balance in this midfield.
No, me neither.
My first one, I guess he's the more defensive. West Ham legend, 414 Premier League appearances. It's Mark Noble, and I'll give you some lore here. You want to talk about lore?
Yeah.
FA Cup, 2015, last season of the Barclays. Ander Herrera was messing about on the pitch.
Yeah.
Mark Noble bear hugs him, picks him up, and drops him off on the side of the touchline. And that was just Mark Noble personified.
Mm.
Just loved the bit of banter. One of the best penalty takers in the league, Mr. West Ham. He's in my team. Easy pick. Was with us throughout the Premier League Barclays era. He's easy.
Okay.
For a bit more flair, only made 86 Premier League appearances. In fact, he made more appearances in the Championship than the Premier League. It's Adel Taarabt.
Yeah, yeah.
QPR, Tottenham, Fulham. Doesn't actually have the best numbers, but if you watch the eye, you could put a highlight reel together of this guy of flicks and turns and passes and just utter brilliance with flair. Not so much by the end product. You know, he does not have the stats to back it up. Went on later in his career, played for some big teams like Milan and Benfica. But when he was in the Premier League with QPR, that's just an iconic player
yeah.
for an iconic team, an iconic era. I think Taarabt fits the Barclaysman build
totally.
To the T.
Streets won't forget. He's prime Barclaysman in terms of attacking players. I wanted to put him in, but there's no room for him in my team.
Okay.
My midfield two is... I've got Johan Cabot.
Okay, good pick.
And I remember him well at Newcastle from 2011 to 2014. And then I love this. He goes to PSG and then to Palace. Like, I love those transfers where they go from a massive club that's, like, competing in Europe to Crystal Palace or Everton or Newcastle or whatever. And he made 175 Premier League appearances, so he was there for those sort of later Barclays years. A French central midfielder, of course. But, he was a decent player, Cabaye. I just picture him in that Newcastle kit. They had a few, like, sort of, I don't know if flashy is the right word. But
Sissoko.
And Cisse and Ben Arfa, too.
Cheick Tiote.
Yes. They had a fun team in sort of the 2010s. Cabaye. And then I've got... This guy I sort of forgot about and then came across him in my research. Sebastian Larsson, a Swedish midfielder, came through at Arsenal, actually, which I didn't know, but really made his name at Birmingham City and Sunderland. And he was a free kick specialist, which I love.
You
want to
talk about
category.
Free kick specialists?
Yeah.
We got one coming up.
Oh, I bet. And 282 Premier League appearances, 26 goals, 26 assists. I'm sure most of them were free kicks. He was great. Swedish, another Scandinavian. But, yeah, I just remember him in that Sunderland kit just curling in free kicks. Every time they got one outside the box, you're thinking, uh-oh. Because he was that good at free kicks. So, yeah, definitely a Barclaysman, Sebastian Larsson.
All right, we're going to move on to left midfield. This guy, for 18 months, this is my... Another West Ham guy, only made 48 Premier League appearances, but he was nominated for the Ballon d'Or. But he only did it for about not even 18 months. He was injured for half his best season. It's Dimitri Payet. This guy, free kick specialist. How do you like them apples? I mean, Crystal Palace at home in the Premier League, United away in the FA Cup, Liverpool away in the league. These are just ones I just remember off the top of my head, this guy. I mean, he was just... world class was Dimitri Payet, and he had Rabona assists. He had to leave West Ham because he cheated on his wife and she demanded that he come back home to Marseille. That's why he left. He was training with the under 21s.
Unbelievable.
We had the infamous Slaven Bilic press conference, like, yeah, we have a player, he wants to leave, and you know, it's Dimitri Payet, and you know, everyone was losing their mind because this guy at the you remember Euro 2016,
yes.
This was the tail end of the Barclays. He scored in that opening game against Romania with the left foot. Injured Ronaldo in the final. They went on to lose that final at home. I mean, it was just chaotic, but it was beautiful chaos. Dimitri Payet, easy pick for me.
That's awesome. Yeah, he was great. He might be if he was there for longer, he'd be too good to be a Barclaysman. But he only had that one stint, so really made his mark. Yeah, I have another Everton player here on the left, Steven Pienaar, a popular pick in the Barclaysman category, but I had to get him in. South African winger. 214 appearances, 22 goals, 38 assists. He signed for Everton permanently in 2008 after a successful loan spell. We got him from Dortmund. And then he went to Spurs, didn't work out, and then he came back to Everton. Nostalgic from 2012 to 2016. So he was great. Him and Baines on the left. That was like the start of my Everton fandom. I remember like one of the earliest games, probably the earliest, to be honest, game I can remember was that 4-4 Everton Man United, and Pienaar scores the goal and takes his shirt off and he's got the God is great on the undershirt. And that was like, that was a big like streets won't forget moment. He was a fan favorite, Pienaar.
All right, right midfielder now. I've got another Everton boy. Mm. Everton and Watford.
Okay.
Spaniard Gerard Deulofeu.
Yes.
This guy
good
had
shout.
A cheeky goal in him. Only 20 goals, 21 assists, and 127 Premier League appearances. Also played for the likes of Barcelona at times in his career. So like you said, just guys who would bounce around and then pop up at mid-table Premier League clubs.
Yep.
Had a bit of flair about him, a bit of quality about him. This guy epitomizes, I think, that mid-2010s era where, you know, you get him on his day, you can't play him, but, you know, his day didn't always come that often.
Yes.
So he's in my right midfield. Him and Payet, I think, can man the flanks pretty
That's
well.
That's a great shout. I was thinking about him, too, but I had another man in instead who was at Everton, but really was in his prime Barclays era at Spurs, Aaron Lennon. Just a get-it-to-the-byline and cross guy. He was quick. He was shifty. But, you know, he wasn't great at Everton, sort of the latter half of his career, but he made a lot of Premier League appearances, 416, 36 goals, 58 assists, just a classic winger in that Barclays era, English. Spurs had a few Barclays men in that era, that Harry Redknapp sort of era. He's probably the Barclays men manager,
right,
or one of, I would say. So, yeah, Aaron Lennon for me, a classic English winger. But sort of reminds me of, in terms of like build and the way he moves, of Sterling a little bit. His arms are kind of fluttering
T-Rex
around,
arms.
And you know he's got a trick up his sleeve, but he's quick, gets you the odd goal. So yeah, Aaron Lennon for me on the right with Steven Pienaar on the left. What a team!
All right, last but not least, the two strikers. This strike duo would cause havoc.
Okay.
All right, first up, another ex-West Ham, but. He was a Barclays man at Stoke. Marco Arnautovic, just a bastard to play against. But on his day, he was quick. He was ruthless. He was a baller. But he'd also decided to leave for China for the money and got fat and then came back to Europe. So he's a bit of a wild
still
card.
Around.
Stoke kicking around. I think he's at Inter.
Yeah.
Still kicking around. Played in the Champions League last
That's
year.
Unbelievable.
Seemed mad because everyone thought his career was done when he went to China.
And he was at Stoke.
Stoke.
Unbelievable.
He's got 184 games, 43 goals, 33 assists, playing for pretty poor teams. And this is the best bit.
Mm.
So when he came to West Ham, we played Stoke. He scored 2 goals. Brilliant. But what was more was when we played, I'm forgetting who now. Who was the Stoke manager at the time?
Tony Pulis?
No, it was great. Mark Hughes.
Yes,
Mark Hughes
Mark
went
Hughes.
On to manage someone else. So it wasn't even Arnautovic scored against Stoke. He scored against a team Mark Hughes was managing. He scores, points his finger, runs towards the touchline, and like gets almost up in his face. That was just him personified. He was a nutcase, nut job.
Oh,
but quality.
Yeah.
And his strike partner, another Stoke guy, but you might as well play the game of who didn't this guy play for. Spurs, QPR, Norwich, Southampton, Portsmouth, Burnley, Liverpool. Played for all these teams.
Him. Yeah.
Peter Crouch. 468 Premier League appearances, 106 goals, 63 assists. I mean, you want to talk about iconic celebrations, the robot celebration. I know everyone knows the robot celebration. Notoriously, a funny guy. He's got a great podcast nowadays. He's getting the royalty on. Seems like a great character. I think he epitomizes what the Barclays men are all about. Him and Arnautovic up top. I mean, that is, you know, a tough duo. Big guy, small guy, quick and slow, hold up play and finishing. You got it all there. Those two round out my 11.
I like it. I have a very different front too. My number 9 is a Spanish striker who played for Swansea City. A lot of people have him in here, but I had to include him. I remember him so well that one season. He only had 52 appearances in the Premier League. 20 goals, though. Michu.
Yep.
Iconic celebration, the salt shaker, whatever it is.
The Mitrovic kind of copied.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure what it is, but you just remember it so vividly. And that Swansea team had a lot of Barclays men. Leon Britton, Wayne Routledge, Nathan Dyer. you know, to name a few. I don't know why.
The IU brothers, maybe.
Yeah, I just remember that team like well for some reason, and they weren't particularly any good. But Brendan Rodgers was there, I remember. So yeah, Swansea have a few. I had to get one of them in. Michu, just that one or two seasons, he was great. And then in behind a second striker who I haven't seen this name thrown around. He should be thrown around. An Everton sort of fan hero, Stephen Naismith. My dad and I used to hate this guy because we thought it was crap. But he scored 20 goals in 116 appearances, and he always scored against Chelsea every time, including a hat trick against Mourinho's Chelsea in 2015. The streets won't forget it.
I forgot it.
It was, yeah, and I think it was a perfect hat trick. I think he went left foot, right foot header.
Wow.
It was just outstanding. So, yeah, Stephen Naismith, he always did this celebration.
Shushing celebration for our
so
listeners.
So pale. Bright blonde hair, Scottish. We didn't really know where to play him. He's one of those guys where he's not a winger. He's not a number nine. You kind of have to just play him in behind and he'll get the odd goal. And he did. And it was always against Chelsea for some reason. So Stephen Naismith, Dad, you'll remember him if you're listening to this. What a player.
What a guy. All right, we put together some good teams. Do we want to do managers or do you not have
one? I didn't have one, but okay. I mean, we talked about Redknapp.
Pulis.
I'm trying to think. Pulis, yeah.
Moyes in there, definitely. Roy Hodgson.
Yeah.
I mean, I think mine actually has to be Big Sam. Sam Allardyce.
Big Sam.
Been around the block. Even made it as the Barclays era was ending. Was the England manager before that, you know, quickly was derailed.
Yeah.
I forget that. Some scandal. But that'll do it for our Barclays Minute 11. Thoroughly enjoyed that.
Yes.
And until next time, thank you for listening.